Now they're weird. Is it hilarious? Thank you. Thank you guys for coming out to this poetry reading this evening. This is the first time Slam the Waddle has ever done something like this. We usually hold open mics, slams, and things of that nature, but we've never had just a poetry reading from one of our favorite poets. And tonight we have Patricia Smith, and she's going to be reading from her various works of poetry. And just a little bit about our organization. We started in 2011. Rob Gibson started the organization, and ever since then, we've just been growing, and these are the fruits of his work and our work as a whole. We met Patricia Smith in 2012 at Cupsy, 2013, at the College Union's Poetry Slam Invitational, and we just, which she thinks we should have won. We just automatically clicked, and it was so cool that she was very down to earth and just a normal person, which we thought she wasn't. But it was awesome, and we're amazed, and we're happy, and we're excited that we got to bring her here. Patricia Smith is the author of Blood Dazzler, which was a National Book Award finalist, Tea House of the Almighty, Close to Death, and It Should Have Been Jimmy Savannah, which is this awesome book right here, which I will be getting signed. Hopefully after the show. And it's very special to have her here tonight. And like, it means a lot to our organization, not only because she's such an amazing person and an amazing poet, but because it seems like she's accomplished something that we admire so much, in that, which is to say that she's made that transition between the slam world and into like the literary world. When we usually talk about that, we don't see a difference, but I know that a lot of people do see that discrepancy, and they say, oh, there's a difference between slam, and there's a difference between, you know, just poetry and books, more literary poetry. And I think from our end, we really don't see a difference. We think any way we can get people writing poetry, we get them writing poetry, because we think poetry heals, poetry is fun, and, you know, it's awesome. So seeing Patricia Smith, reading up on her and seeing that she used to slam, and then now she's all the way over here doing National Book Award winning shit. It's pretty crazy. Like, so we just appreciate that so much, and we just appreciate her as a whole. And without further ado, I introduce to you guys poet Patricia Smith.
Thank you so much. I am very happy to be here. It took us a while to get it done, but we got it done. And y'all should have won, really. I still talk about that. They're tired of me talking about that in New York, but hey. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Good to see all of you. All right, I start all my readings out with the same poem, and I've done that for a number of years. And after a while, I said, well, everybody who's going to see me has seen this poem, so why am I still doing it? I realized that the first big trip that I took as a poet, I was invited to Miami to work with a group of sixth graders. And the area that I was in had a high incidence of drug use, so a lot of the kids had lost parents or brothers or sisters to AIDS. And I came bounding in saying, I'm here to teach you poetry. And they're like, how are you going to make our lives better? You know. And there was a little girl there named Nicole, and her mother had died the week before, and she was already back in school. And she wanted me to teach her to write a poem about her mother. So I figured out that I do this poem because it reminds me of the power that language has to move you from one place in your head to a safer place, which is what she was asking me to help her do. So this poem is dedicated to the sixth grade class at Lily Sevens Elementary School in Dade County, Miami, which they made me promise to say every time I do the poem. I am astonished at their mouthful names, Lacanicia, Chevalane, DeLeo, Fumaleo, their ragged rebellions and lip gloss pouts and all those pants drooped as drapery. I rejoice when they kiss my face, whisper wet and urgent in my ear, make me their obsession because I have brought them poetry. They shout me raw, bruise my wrist with their pulling, and brashly claim me as mama as they cradle my head in their little laps, waiting for new words to grow in my mouth. You. Angry, jubilant, weeping poets, we are all saviors, reluctant hosannas in the limelight. But you knew that, didn't you? So let us bless this sixth grade class. 40 cracking voices, 40 nappy heads, and all of them raise their hands when I ask. They have all seen the Reaper, grim in his heavy robe, pushing the button for the dead project elevator, begging for a break at the corner pawn shop, cackling wildly in the back pew of the Baptist church. I ask the death question, and 40 fist punch the air. Me, an O'Neill matchstick crack child watched his mother's body become a claw. And 9-year-old Tico Jefferson, barely big enough to lift the gun, fired a bullet into his throat when Mama bended his back with a lead pipe. Tamika cried into a sofa pillow when Daddy blasted Mama into the north wall of their cluttered one-room apartment. Danya's cousin, gone in a drive-by, dark window, click, 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 gone, says Danya, her tiny finger a barrel, the thumb a hammer. I am astonished at their losses. And yet when I read a poem about my own hard-eyed teenager, Jeffrey asks, is he dead yet? Cannot be comprehended. My 18-year-old still pushing and pulling his own breath. And 40 faces pity me, knowing that I will soon be as they are, numb to our bloodied histories, favoring the Reaper with a thumbs up and a wink, hearing the question and shouting, me, Miss Smith, I know somebody dead. Can poetry hurt us, they ask me, before crawling into my words to sleep. I love you, Nicole says. Nicole wearing my face, pimples peppering her nose, and she is as black as angels are. Nicole's braids kissed with match flame to seal them. And can you teach me to write a poem about my mama, Miss Smith? I mean, you write about your daddy, and he's dead. Can you teach me to remember my mama? A teacher tells me this is the first time Nicole has admitted that her mother is gone. Murdered by slim silver needles and a stranger rifling through her blood, the virus pushing her skeleton through for Nicole to see. And now this child with rusty knees and mismatched shoes sees poetry as her scream and asks me for the words to build her mother again, replacing the voice, stitching on the lost flesh. So poets, as we take the stage, as we flirt and sin and rejoice behind microphones, remember Nicole. She knows that we are here now, and she is an empty vessel waiting to be filled. And she is waiting, and she's waiting. And she waits. I watch a lot of bad movies, and I get a lot of good poems from bad movies. And this poem was inspired by Clash of the Titans, not the new one. I don't play with the new one, the old, the whole Ray Harryhausen special effects. You know that when you're getting ready for school and you see the skeletons fighting on TV, that you just don't go, right? You just go, I gotta watch the rest of this. This was inspired by the Medusa scene. He has to get Medusa's head. So when I see it, I said, I used to read a lot of mythology. Why did I forget how Medusa became Medusa? Medusa became Medusa because she made love to Poseidon in Athena's temple. And Poseidon was Athena's man. And Athena was like, oh, no, you didn't do that. So that's, she said, okay, we're going to do this thing. So you look at any other man, they're going to turn to stone. I said something really dirty last time I did this poem. I'm not going to say it here. Anyway, you look at any other man, you can figure out what it is, right? Anyway, you look at any other man, they're going to turn to stone. And then she was like, okay, got you. She's walking away. She's like, no, wait a minute. And then we did the hair thing. Okay. So this is a poem in Medusa's voice as her body is going through these changes. 3-minute introduction, 1-minute poem. Poseidon was easier than most. He calls himself a god, but he fell beneath my shaking with more shaking than any mortal. He wept when my robe fell from my shoulders. I made him bend his back for me, listen to his screams break like waves. We defile that temple the way it should be defiled, squirming and bucking our way from corner to corner. You know, the bitch goddess probably got a real kick out of that. I'm sure I'll be hearing from her. She'll give me nightmares for a week or so that I can handle, or she'll turn the water in my well into blood. I'll scream when I see it, and that'll be that. Maybe my first child will be born with the head of a fish. I'm not even sure it was worth it. Poseidon pounding away at me like a madman, losing his immortal mind because of the way my copper skin swells in moonlight. Now my arms smoke and itch. Hard scales are rising on my wrists like armor. Come on, Athena. He was just another lay and not a particularly good one at that, even though he could spit steam from his fingers. I won't touch him again. Promise. And we didn't mean to drop to our knees in your temple, but our bodies were so hot and misaligned. It's not every day a gal gets the sample of God, you know that. Why are you being so rough on me? I feel my eyes twisting, the lids crusting over and boiling, the pupils glowing like red coals. Athena, woman to woman, could you have resisted him? Would you have been able to wait for the proper place, the right moment, to jump those immortal bones? Now my feet are tangled with hair. My ears are gone. My back is curving and my lips have grown numb. My garden boy just shattered at my feet. Damn it, Athena! Take away my father's gold. Send me away to live with lepers. Give me a pimple or two. But my face, to have men never again gaze at my face, growing stupid in anticipation of that first touch, how can any woman live like that? How can I watch their warm bodies turn to rock when their only sin was desiring me? They just want to see me sweat. They just want to touch my face and run their fingers through my hair. Is it moving? Thank you. Okay, angry poem. I don't know if anybody here has been keeping up with what happened at the National Book Awards. Okay, National Book Awards, Jacqueline Woodson, an amazing YA author, wins for Best YA Book of the Year, National Book Awards. And I've been to the National Book Awards, so it's this big thing. They got paparazzi and the sweeping searchlights and everybody's, you know. And the guy who was the MC, Daniel Handler, after she accepted her award, said, I'm going to tell you something I bet you didn't know, and I'm paraphrasing, that Jackie Woodson is allergic to watermelon. Just going to say. So that's why I'm going to read a mad poem now. I had to do a gig in Seattle, and it was called Strong Female Leads. And you had to write an entirely new show. You had to write a whole set of poems about women who were strong in literature, in film, or in television, but they couldn't be strong because they had a weapon. Anybody strong with a flamethrower, okay? So this was women who were strong for some of the reasons. So I was trying to come up with people, women who wouldn't be typical. So you guys watch Tom and Jerry. So you know if you watch enough Tom and Jerry, eventually you'll see a black woman's legs. Okay, so I got really obsessed with finding out who she was. So she has a name, and of course it's not like Mary or Joanne or something, because I couldn't do that. Her name is Mammy Two Shoes. Yeah, thank you. And she has a website. And the website has every instance of her legs appearing in the cartoon and the one instance where you saw her face. And Tom, by the way, is her cat. The mistress of the house gave the cat to her. So this is Mammy Two Shoes, rightful owner of Tom, addresses the lady of the house. I am charming double negative, an overwrought belly of dirty window. I carry the syrupy burden of your love in my yawning breeches of body. When I laugh, a sound riding like knotted oil on each breath I draw, I spread my lips wide so you can see that my canines are obediently filed flat. My bite, without an evident engine, is of no threat to you, no matter how much I'm drawn to the lily-spiced bouquet of your throat. I stammer, spurt spittle, and rewind, coaxing submerged venom past what I'm sure you have forgotten is an African tongue. I have mastered the Google eye, managed vex and fluster when confronted with your dry idioms and piquant nouns. See how I throw up chubby, buttered hands in defeat, awaiting your bemused but kind correction. If I expect my wooden bed beside the porch and the slithery scraps you barely remember not to throw away, then you expect this of me. I am your beloved other, a sexless stovetop stinking of cinnamon, but I am impossibly unlit, such black whale that once the sun sinks, my voice rides the air alone, so black that you've considered bolting my ghost to the floor of the kitchen so you can find me in the morning. I'm only simple-minded on cue. I have stood in the wet dark of the pantry, weeping, twisting the blaring light from my fist to keep from striking you. I have plunged chunks of bread into warm bacon grease and crammed my mouth away from exploding. You need to believe that yes is the all of my language, that I am conjured of comic bulbous gaze and the head droop, forever on the verge of a grand gospel weep. I want you to believe that I believe that a merciful God laid me at your feet. There are days I feel heart from my knees to the tile, calves thick like the trunks of trees kissed by the scalloped hem of a daisied apron. My chapped heels overflow my shoes. Thank you, Jesus. I never have to lift my feet from this floor. It's best if I walk as if I were being dragged, which is so, so much easier on the soul. Did I remember to bless you for blessing me, Mrs., with that tomcat, skanked and feral, flea-bitten, steady out of his head with motivation and mange? Did I ever thank you for pushing a cat into the space where any other woman's own child would be? You gave me a look down, a relationship with the floor, permission to wag a flabby finger at something, a little push-pull, oh no you didn't, kingdom to rule, an official reason to flap my gums and call on Jesus for help. I say, Tom, you's in that icebox, you better start praying. I say, Lord, Lord Thomas, is that a mouse? And just like that, I'm up on a chair, all a jiggle, a chair bound to collapse under my overload, my eyes wide like they've been slapped from behind. In 20 years, you've given me pussy and vermin, the same way you gave me your children, your squirming, babbling, corn-silk-crowned boys who started their lives by scarring my breast with their blunt new teeth, who have mounted my body and ridden every tired surface that would hold them. Their fingers gloppy with jelly and snot. They have pried beneath my head rag for the mystery of my hair. They have scraped my forearm and cheek raw and looked for black to be that something alive beneath their fingernails. And yes, they've slowly gone stupid with the sugar, lard, and mouse droppings I shovel into their bowls, then into their mouths. And I smile. I slip a razor into the space between my teeth and the wet wall of my cheek, and I smile. At night, after I have thanked God for the each of you, I never sleep. A soldier, I shamble along the floorboards, the cat licking my heels, that damn mouse skittering blue notes beneath the stove. When I tire, I'm careful not to swallow. I stand outside your door, listening to the capture and unlatch of your breath. I move the blade to my resting tongue. Again, I moan. Yes, and God says, all right, so this poem is about, I have a 19-year-old, and when, I'm sorry if this makes men uncomfortable, sorry, but when she was about 12, she was on the road with me, and her period started, and she woke me up, and she was just like, it's here, it's here, it's here, she was all happy, and so she had all these questions, and I talked to her, and we answered questions, and it started me thinking about the role of blood in women's lives. But she was so happy that what we did when we got back home, we went to the dollar store and we bought a bunch of red feather boas. We invited five of her female friends over and we put on music with lots of drums. And they were like, ooh, you know, they had no idea what they're celebrating, but it was really cool. This is like a little ritual. Anyway, so I started thinking about the role of blood in women's lives. So I wrote three little poems. One was me at age 12. The other one is my husband and I when we were both married to other people. Don't judge me. The other one is Michaela when she discovered. So the blood sonnets. One, me, age 12. Sure that I was dying, that I died, that the gush of iron smell and black thick splash signaled all my sin gone wide. I pried open the thin wobbly back of a record cabinet and crammed my underwear inside. My mother had told me nothing about my body, damned to swell, sprout hair, creak, and bleed toward old, so I hid the stiff, soiled Carters there among the music, wedged wrong in that bladed jazz and blues I didn't dare dance to. Gangly child, I was still small but too plumped to rest in my mama's lap. Stashing my music, I braced for her slap. Two. My husband's like, I don't believe you're reading that. Brash, adulterous fools, you and I clash in a rented bed, this tryst ill-conceived, the longed-for coupling off by days. I bleed so much it seems a kill has taken place, my body grieving its harbor of woman, but do we slow, think, push apart, stop? No. Believing this chaos to be faded, we're slow to see the sheets wide streaked, scarlet, the fat drops peppering the carpet, my thighs burned red. Until you deadpan, we better call the cops. Looks like murder. Somebody must be dead. Spent in the midst of our vicious crime, we phone our other lives, and we lie about the time. Three, Michaela. The purplish clot fascinated you, didn't it? The way it woke you and trembled in your jammies like a clue you hadn't asked for. You slid your hand inside the cleft, wiggled fingers stained with, new me, Grandma. We rose that night and sistered for hours. Questions reigned. Where's the egg? And answers were your right and my relief. I took final stock. Age 11, size 10, feet, my height. Oh God, my girl, my woman, the shock of sweet you lurching forward just might kill me. Let's ignore the creeping sands. Let's laugh and clasp each other's bloody hands. I have a really hard time getting my students to write. So it was my poetry class, and it was the day of their final, and they came in, shoulders all slumped, poetry, yeah. And I waited till they took their seats, and I said, "No final today." And they carried me around the room on their shoulders. Yeah. And I said, instead, I said, "What was your most difficult age?" 19, 27. This year, whatever this year is my most. The consensus was 13. And when you think about it, yes, we were all miserable at 13. If you had skin, something was wrong with it. There was all this kind of nether region action happening that you didn't understand. The guys' voices were cracking. The girls were too tall. Their legs were skinny. It was just all messed up. So I told them, I said, "Well, your new final is, I want you to write a poem about being 13. I want it to be 13 stanzas, 13 lines, 13 syllables each line." And they did. And anytime I give them something like that, I do it. So my 13 was not like their 13. And I won't read all of them, but I'll read a few of them. 13 ways of looking at 13. I just got through talking about menstruation in the first. Okay. I'm not obsessed. Okay. 1. You touch your forefinger to the fat clots in the blood, then lift its iron stench to look close, searching the globs of black scarlet for the dimming swirl of dead children. You thread one thick pad's cottony tail, then the other through the little steel guides of the belt. You stand and lift the contraption, press your thighs close to adjust the bulk, then bend to pull up coarse white cotton panties bleached blue, and, just to be safe, you pin the bottom of the pad to the shredding crotch of the Carters. Then you spritz the guilty air with the cloying kiss of FDS. Nobody knows what I'm talking about. It's time to begin the game of justifying ache. Time to name the mystery prickling that's riding your skin. You're convinced the boys can smell you, and they can. 2. Right now, this Tuesday in July, nothing's headier than the words sheen, manageable, bounce. Squinting into the smeared mirror, you search your head for them. You probed with greased fingers, spreading paths in the chaos, wide enough for the advertised glimmer to escape, but your snarls hold tight to their woven dry confounding. Fevered strands snap under the drag of the wiry brush, and order unfurls, while down the hall, Mama rotates the hot comb in a bleary blaze and smacks her joyful gum. Still, TV bellows its promise. You witness the pink snap of the perfect neck, hear the impossible vow, shampoo with this, sheen, bounce. Her corn silk head is gospel. It's so true. Come here, child. Even your mother's calling you burns. 4. Trying hard to turn hips to slivers, sway to stutter, you walk past the Sinclair station where lanky boys, dust in their hair, dressed in their uniforms of oil and thud, rename you pussy with their eyes. They bring sound, shudder, and blue from their throats just for you, serve up ancient sonata of skin drum and conch shell, sing suggesting woos of AM radio. Boom, boom, how you just gonna walk on by like that? And suddenly, you know why you are stitched so tight, crammed like a flash bomb into pinafore, obeying your mama's instructions to be a baby as long as you can. Because it's a man's world, and James Brown is gasoline, the other side of slow zippers. He is all of it, the pump, pump, the growled, please, please, please. 8. In the bathroom of the whatnot joint on the way to school, you get rid of the starch and billowed lace, barrettes taming unraveling braids, white knee socks, and sensible hues. From a plastic bag, you take out electric blue eyeshadow, platforms with silver glittered heels, neon fishnets, and a blouse that doesn't so much button as suggest shut. The transformation takes 5 minutes. And you emerge feeling like a budding lady, but looking, in retrospect, like a blind streetwalker bursting from a cocoon. This is what television does. Turns your mother into clueless backdrop, fills your pressed head with the probability of thrum. Your body becomes just not yours anymore. It's a dumb little marquee. 9. With your bedroom door closed, you are skyscraper bouffant, peach foundation, eyelashes like upturned claws. You are exuding ice. You are pinched all over by earrings. You are way too much woman for this room. The audience has one chest, a single shared chance to gasp. They shudder, heave, waiting for you to open your mouth and break their hearts. Taking the stage, you become an S, pour ache into hip swings, tisk tisk as the front row collapses. Damn, they want you. You lift the microphone. Something illegal comes out of you, a sound like titties and oil. Mama flings the door open with a church version of your name. Then you are pimpled, sexless, ashed, and double Dutch knees. You are spindles. You are singing into a hairbrush. 13. You're almost 14. And you think you're ready to push beyond the brutal wisdoms of the one and the three, but some nagging crave in you doesn't want to let go. You suspect that you will never be this unfinished. All Hail Mary and precipice, stuttering sachet, fuses in your swollen chest suddenly lit and spitting, and you'll need to give your hips a name for what they did while you weren't there. You'll miss the pervasive fever that signals blooming, the sore lessons of jump rope in your calves. This is the last year your father is allowed to touch you. Sighing, you push Barbie's perfect body through the thick dust of a top shelf. There, her prideful heart thunders. She has heartened you well. She has taught you everything. Okay, I just decided that I'm going to read one poem from every book. Okay, so that was this one. So now this one. And then this one. If I have time. And then one more. And then one new one. And they'll be finished. We good? Okay. This is Blood Dazzlers, a book of poems written about Hurricane Katrina. Katrina's personified in this book. So I think I'll do a poem in her voice at the moment that she becomes a Category 5 storm. 8 a.m. Sunday, August 28th, 2005. For days, I've been offered blunt slivers of larger promises. Even flesh, my sweet recurring dreams, has been tantalizingly dangled before me. I have crammed my mouth with buildings, brushed aside skimpy altars, snapped shut windows to bright shadow with my fingers, and I've warned them. Soft. You must not know my name. Could there be other weather, other divas stalking the cringing country with insistent eye? Could there be other rain laced with the slick flick of electric and my own pissed boom? Or could this be it? My praise day. All my fist at once. Now officially a bitch. I'm confounded by words. All I've ever been is starving, fluid, and noise. So I huff a huge sulk, thrust out my chest, and open wide my solo swallowing eye. You must not know. Scarlet glare fixed on the trembling crescent. I fly. Thank you. Now that I've decided to do this, I have to figure out what poem. Little one. Little poem. Okay. That's a terrible poem. Okay. This is One of my favorite segment of the population, the old black men, because you can't get over on anything with them. They already know everything. So it's like we had the internet. What was it, Charlie? Back in 42? You know, we had that World Wide Web, you know, and you just, before they get through talking, you're like, yeah, they probably did have the internet. Okay. So one of my favorite old black men is John Lee Hooker. You know John Lee? John Lee Hooker, blues guy, about this tall, big Stetson hat, big glasses, just evil for no reason. everything was down here with him, you know. So this is called How to Be a Lecherous Little Old Black Man and Make Lots of Money. First, you got to get the blues. This is easy if you are a person of any gender and possess a pulse, a cheating lover, a stalking ex-lover, a used Yugo, a pumping heart, an empty wallet, a half-dead dog, an empty refrigerator, one last cigarette butt, a good memory, a nosy mama, a lonely room, a quick trigger, roving eyes, an addiction to whiskey, nothing but the clothes on your back, a Jones for your neighbor's wife, a Jones for your wife's neighbor, a positive test result, an itching to leave, an itching to stay, or any itching where there shouldn't be one. Rub your hands slow over your body. Feel the valleys and the wrongs. Let misery chump your spine toward collapsing. Let it fold your whole self double. Then you can walk like John Lee Hooker do. Click, shuffle, bent over, nose to the ground, wearing a cock-brimmed felt fedora that wouldn't dare fall off. Then you can think like John Lee do. I'm old as Victrola. Gotta buy a bottle of Mrs. Butterworth if I want to feel a woman. But I can still sing better than you. Thank you. Always carry your own books. That's what I say. This is my son on cover. My son never wanted to have anything to do with anything. He would like sit at my readings and sit in the back of the room. It's like, don't point me out. Don't say my name. Don't point to you. You know that phase they go through? They don't want any, and then all of a sudden, it's just like, you going to introduce me tonight? You going to tell them? Yeah. So when I first got this book, they send a box to the house, and my books were disappearing. And I said, you know, I was like, who's taking my books, right? So he was taking the book, signing the front, and passing them out to girls. Like, yo, this is me. I'm like, the books cost money. All of a sudden, he was like a star, right? Okay, anyway. So I wrote this book for him. He was at a stage where a lot of young men his age were just kind of flirting with street violence. Like, they had no reason to, but for some reason, they thought, well, I'm living in this little picket fence neighborhood. I don't want to do that. I want to get out here where the real action is. And I wanted to let him know what we would be left with if he risked his life and lost it. So it's called Close to Death, but the reason it has C2D up here is because they were selling hats in New York with C2D on them. And when I asked them what that meant, they said it meant close to death. And I said, who's buying those? And they said, well, mostly young black men. So I was just trying to figure that out. So this is a poem called Undertaker, and I'd done an interview with an undertaker in an area where I was living at the time. There was a lot of violence and a lot of kids were getting shot in the head. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you have to do when you receive a body where the person's been shot in the head? And he was telling me, and he said, wait a minute, I have a body in the basement that I'm preparing for burial. Do you want to watch? Which he wasn't supposed to do. And there's these moments I tell my students about where, of course, I don't want to go. But you know that if you do, it's not only going to change the poem that you write, but it's going to change everything you write from then on. So a little bit of what I saw is in this poem. But he told me that his job had changed because it used to be older members of families would die from natural causes. But then every time his phone would ring, he would hate to pick it up because it would be a young mother asking him to bury her son. So that's the background, a little bit much too much talking. When a bullet enters the brain, the head explodes. I can think of no softer warning for the young mothers who sit doubled before my desk, nodding their smooth brown hands and begging, "Fix my boy. Fix my boy." Here's his high school picture. In the mildly mustachioed player in the crinkled snapshot looks nothing like the plastic bag of boy stored and dated in the cold room downstairs. In the picture, he is cocky and chiseled, clutching the world by the balls. I know the look. Now he has flaps of cheek, slivers of jawbone, a surprised eye, assorted teeth, bloody tufts of napped hair, the building blocks of my business. So I turned the photo face down to talk numbers instead. The high price of miracles startles the young mother, but she is prepared. I know that she has sold everything she owns, that cousins and uncles have emptied their empty bank accounts, that she dreams of her baby in tuxedoed satin, flawless, in an open casket, a cross or blood-red rose tacked to his fingers, his halo set at a cocky angle. So I write a figure on a piece of paper and push it across to her. She stares at the number. Jesus. But Jesus isn't on my payroll. I work alone until the dim insistence of morning, gluing, stitching, creating a chin with a brushstroke. I plump shattered skulls, then paint the skin to suggest warmth and impending breath. I plop glass eyes into rigid sockets, then carve eyelids from a forearm and inner thigh. I reach into collapsed cavities to rescue a tongue, an ear. Lips are never easy to recreate. And I tried not to remember the stories, the tales the mothers must tell me to ease their own hearts. Oh, they cry, my Ronnie, my David, my Michael, my Chico. He was on the way home. Somebody slowed down. A car slowed down. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was just trying to get his life together. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Fix my boy. He was a good boy. Make him the way he was. But I have explored the jagged gaps in the boy's body. And I have soothed the angry edges of bullet holes. I have touched him in places no mother knows, and I have birthed his new face. I know he believed himself invincible, that he most likely hissed, "Fuck you, man," before the bullets lifted him off his feet. I try not to remember his swagger, his lizard-lidded gaze, his young mother screaming into the phone. She says that she will find the money to bury him. And I know that is the truth that fuels her, forces her to place one foot in front of the other. Suddenly, I want to take her down to the chilly room, open the bag, and shake its terrible bounty onto the gleaming steel table. I want her to see him, to touch him, to press her lips to the flap of cheek, because the woman needs to wither, finally, and move on. We both jump as the phone rattles in its hook. I pray it's my wife, a bill collector, a wrong number. But the wide, questioning silence on the other end is too familiar. It's another mother needing a miracle. It's another homeboy coming home. I was just talking to Kathleen, Professor Grabe, about poems that, you know, your first book and poems that you would change basically everything.
There used to be a show on television called Romper Room. Yeah, okay. So Romper Room was like being in a kindergarten classroom, okay? It was live. And it was like, you know, if somebody put a camera in a kindergarten class, it was art and there was music. And there was a teacher. So you would watch the show, but there was this really weird segment at the end where the teacher would come up to the camera and she would, you'd send your name in, right? And she'd say, oh, I see you, I see Mary, I see David. And I, of course, being my age, thought she was really looking into the so I'm in front of the television like, yo, hey, Patricia, right here, you know. And she never said my name, but if you look online long enough, you will see that there was a Romper Room lady who went crazy on the air, and she ran around and started trying to strangle the kids. I mean, at one point she was singing a nursery rhyme, and then her eyes got wide. She was like, you bastards, you know. So this is her. You can't do anything in front of a poet. We'll just, like, put your business in the street. Okay. Romper Room lady. When doorknobs began to feel cold beneath her fingers, she dreaded the twisting, the opening, the biting frost, and full jazz snatches bound to slap her full in the face. So she learned to keep her hands very slowly at her side. Such a proper oatmeal. 3, 2, 1. Once again, she poured her pupils tight into the camera. I see Damon. I see Kara. I see Michael. I see Sharon. She didn't see shit. She never did see anyone. But they demanded the creation of box-top children, of toddlers with inquisitive blue ovals, with A's and B's and C's marching in uniform stupidity down their throats. She sensed rebellion in the silks of their hair. She smelled something crazy in the pale, sinewy skin at their necks. She could hear their hearts beating telltale rhythms. A, B, C, D, E, F. No! If only she could pull their withery sing-song voices away from her face. If only her thighs didn't lean forward at night, remembering their sputter talk, their 60, 70 snaking fingers. If only she didn't always break just short of the stoplight. Terrorized by primary colors. Never wanting to reach home, where her nights were indelibly haunted by the farmer in the fucking dell, and her screams were shaped like the heads of children. I'm just thinking back to that wonderful introduction. People are probably thinking, now why did they invite this crazy-ass woman here again? In February 2010, 21-year-old student Safshid Abdur Rahim abducted his 3-month-old daughter, Zara. He placed her in a knapsack, drove to a bridge on the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey, and threw her out of the passenger side window of his car. She drowned in the Raritan River, more than 100 feet below. In November 2011, also in New Jersey, Arthur Morgan picked up his 2-year-old daughter, Tierra, for a trip to the movies. Later, Tierra was found face down in a frigid stream beneath a park overpass, strapped into a car seat, which had been weighed down with a car jack. It was unclear whether she was thrown from the overpass or carried into the park and placed in the water. The 5 stages of drowning. 1, surprise. There is no drunk like the drunk of milk sleep. Drizzled white floods the body and weighs down everywhere we knew about awake. Zara's fresh clockwork staggers with it when her daddy, grizzled and wild-eyed, lobs her like a bag of trash over the rusting rail. Inside the sack, the wriggling child does not know the words, fly, plummet, or descend. She doesn't realize the quirky questions she poses for the pigeons or how, dimmed and stupid with dairy, she is all the fall the sky can language. Trickling from the breast does what it does. Babies accept what they are given. They don't question the morning's crazed deluge of light, a kitchen's blaring stink, or the hungry, hovering faces of fathers. Even after a swollen breeze pries her eyes open in the seconds it takes for the fevered discarding of a daughter, baby doesn't ask the sun, spiraling into the sack, to offer direction. Zara Malani Lynn Abdul Rahim, little not bird, has been jettisoned, ditched, unloaded. Her snared arms fight and fail to find a suitable rhyme for wing. The river's luminous trash smacks her blunt, but not before her mouth fails its O, not before language breaks its promise to wait for her. If Zara can reach no word for word, no term for the dawning of no, what questions can a pale breath answer? Can this daddy's girl, crammed breakneck into a down, down, down that reeks so wildly of him, grieve the dearth of love when she has no sound for love? 2, involuntary breath holding. Imagine filling your body with all that you are, and then holding it there. Imagine your body being small, your life consisting of nothing but primary colors and food, fingers smushed, and the stumbling possibilities of dance. Imagine not knowing that whether or not you can contain all of you in tiny ballooned cheeks decides whether or not you will continue. Imagine not knowing the word continue. Wisp of fish nibble warily at those fat cheeks, fall into irreparable love, and decide to make a religion of you. Hallelujah, you are now a religion. You are now a church of silt and slither, while daddy roars glee into noontime traffic, thinking not about you, but about your mother, and screeching, oh, so she got another man now, huh? Well, fuck that hoe. I bet this gonna fix her bitch ass now. And you, Tierra, you are the fix for her bitch ass now. You are the fix for your mother's ass now. You are the mute bystander in a gon' be right now reprisal that cannot be retracted. And your daddy, now miles away from your plunging, does a slipshod parking job and ambles into a smoky, red-splashed gin mill populated by other men without daughters. Hoisting a fat gold shot, he toasts his one accomplishment, the sweet, uncomplicated removal of a complication. Your cheek deflates and the door to your next minute closes. You were alive when the stream first lapped its way round you, and the d sound comes easy to the mouth of a baby who wants it. You laughed, daddy, daddy, until even the giddy fish reexamined their worship of you. You chirped, daddy, daddy, until daddy stopped meaning anything, and you spat into the mud until you couldn't, and the fickle fish, back in love, drew close to kiss the place where your breath had been. 3, hypoxic convulsions. Daddy is the king of architect of a baby girl's roll and rock. He teaches her to manage slink, schools her in the mad politic of the wet engine, makes sure she remembers not to breathe in neon. If Zara lives, which she most definitely will not, someone else's daddy will teach her all the one way there is not to get lured into a sack. How to lay quietly in the wrong skirt while muscles bloom. How a well-timed convulsion will usually clear the dance floor. Good dancing, like good drowning, hits the backside like an annoyance that must be watusied loose. But how does wee colored respond to a wet that seeks to rearrange her? Of course, drums are injected, and Tierra, thrash and snapdragon, shimmies for her giggle back. Baby is the battery that black women build their bodies around until they are saved, old enough to be officially romanced by the latest edition of Jesus. Zara hasn't felt the full hand of the Jesus voice, but she's flirting with that big daddy for all her little worth. Look at her itty bitty jerkin' boogaloo, that pop swirl of hips she can't find, that runaway rim shot in an unfinished chest. She's rearing back, opening wide, rearing back, opening wide. Two maws struggle and fill with river, fill with river, fill with river. Y'all know that nasty music was gonna define that child sooner or later. Brackish water picks up on the wet rhythm and controls Zara's arms and ankles It gleefully involves the neck. It says, baby, save the last dance for me. 4, unconsciousness. The river, though. She's sluggish and cagey and a bitch sometimes. She has not yet decided to accept Zara, this annoyance in her mouth. The river is crafted of choke, flopped blossom, and the seduced diver. She is repulsed by the unremarkabilities of skin. Seldom is she in a mood to have her swerve analyzed or interrupted. Prying the sack wide with flow, she prods the puckered contents, is not entertained. Intending to add the ugly, pudgy bauble to her collection, she finds that she cannot rouse it, is not entertained. The little brown knot fish thing is so flaccid, so unfun, all snazzed up in its sopping petal pink, the eyes closed and rolling, nappy crown trapping things that need to breathe. The most devoted feeders have already had their go at it. The hide slides, puckers, and burps, and damned if the thing won't offer the river proper due. It won't beg for its place in the water's arms. It won't say anything. The river flicks her flat finger at it, then flicks it away. She is so over this drama. The end of anything is only a kick to watch once. 5, clinical death. The final stage of the drowning process is death. Clinical death occurs when both breathing and circulation stop. The victim is in cardiac arrest. The heart stops pumping blood. The vital organs are no longer receiving oxygen-rich blood. The lack of oxygen causes the skin to turn blue. There are 52 shades of blue, or 1,000,052, depending upon which river you ask. 3, cornflower. 17, cerulean. 21, blunt force. 28, turquoise. 34, navy. 37, fix for her bitch ass now. 41, sky. 47, goodbye, but the way the river says it, bye, all dismissal and shade. 52, goodbye, but the way her daddy says it, over his shoulder, thrilling the done of the deed, already mad at the traffic. Thank you. Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions, which was not part of the story, but... Yes.
I just wanted to know, what role does faith play in the writing process?
I would probably say that my entire writing process from the beginning was not so much faith on a face that lifted me up as it was an exploration of faith, because my life changed so much from one time to the next that it's basically, at one point, Toni Morrison said that each one of her books is an answer to a question that she did not yet know the answer to. And I think that my process of writing is me trying to figure out essentially where I am rooted, how strongly, and why. So I think it's an exploration of faith more than I can point to and say, this is where faith has lifted me, this is where it's lifted me, because I don't profess to really know that answer right now, but that's what I'm looking for. Sure. Anybody else? Yes.
Alliteration. What? How?
Alliteration? You should see the look on his face. He's like,
Because it's all over your work, and it's done so tastefully that I just want to know, like, was there a moment when that just like clicked to you, like this is how I can tell stories, or like it's time to do it here, like I can do it here but I'm not going to do it here, like how, what is that to
okay you? That's kind of a two-pronged process, and I use the word process because it's not that formal, but my father came up from Alabama to Chicago, and he brought with him something I like to call the tradition of the back porch. End of every day, my father had to sit down, I had to sit at his feet, and he had to tell me a story. And it was all about the candy factory where he worked, or somebody who was messing with somebody's wife, or I started to look at the world in terms of the stories it could tell. You know, and it was also, it wasn't only the content of the stories, but the way he put the words together and everything. So that's at the base of it. Then I'm a Motown baby. That music, with both its rhythmic qualities and also the fact that all the songs told stories. I heard stories that were, you know, rhythmic at the same time from very, very young age, okay? I cannot say at any point, I do edit for sound, but I don't say, oh, I need I say it, and if it feels, if I've never heard it said that way before, or if I can hear, if I can get my content across and add music to it, I'll keep it. And that's probably where that comes in, but although I'm not thinking of it that technically, like this line needs alliteration, this needs this. I also got introduced to poetry by getting up on stage and doing it. So sound is paramount there, you know. So if you write something and you take it to the stage and you're saying it and your mouth, you know, it's tangling and you say, no, that's not going to work. So the next time you say it another way. You know, it's got to sound good to me, and it's got to mix with the line after it and the one before it. You know, so in essence, it's like writing a song, you know. And luckily, when I stopped performing in that way and turned primarily to the page, I didn't lose that sound in my head. Then when I went to get my MFA, I studied under this woman who's like the meter queen, and she, the first time I met her, I'm talking to her, she's looking at my mouth. And I said, are you scanning what I'm saying? And she said, yes, I am. You know? And she told me that because I cared so much about how the words hit the open air, I was already writing in meter. I just didn't know what the names of it was. So then I'd start to discover all the cool things that poets could do technically to help heighten the reader's response or the listener's response to the poem. And I think that's where that all comes in. I fell in love with the sound of poetry before anything else. And I think that's why I don't look at it so technically as, you know, the alliteration. I'll say it and say, oh, can I say this in a way that zeroes in more on the meaning and adds more music? And I think in that process, that's where a lot of that comes in, although I'm not calling it that per se. So... but thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
Who are some of your favorite poets? Like, who do you like to listen to? What charges you up to write?
I can't read other poets write when I'm getting ready to write. When that happens, I find that the next three poems I write sound, if I like their work, it sounds exactly like them, which is a process, and then you fold, you know, you take what you need from them and you fold it into your own signature and you move on. But it's hard for me to do that because it makes me see how many people are so much more immensely talented than me, and I get discouraged and I don't want to write. I would love to say, and I usually do, I will, some people that I'm reading that I really enjoy, but I constantly think back that when I first got started and I would go to this venue on a Sunday night, and the place was packed with people who pumped gas, you know, just got out of jail, secretaries, school teachers, you know, whatever. And it was vitally important to them to be there that night and read something that was foremost in their minds. And I so am in awe of those people. And I think back to people. There was a woman who was reading when I first got started. Her name was Lisa Biscani. And the first poem I heard, the first persona poem I heard from her was actually the first persona poem I heard, I think. She had written a poem in the voice of the barber who cut the hair before people went into gas chambers. She finished it, and I just had never, it was like a punch in the gut, you know? So a lot of times it's those one-shot people that you see and never see again that kind of lift you up and move you forward and say, there's a reason to do this.
which is why when people say, do you ever think, who do you picture in the audience when you're doing this? There's always one person in every audience who, there might be a line that's inconsequential in your poem that gets them to run out of the room and go pick up a pen or something, you know? So a lot of open micers, you know, people that, you know, some of them are still in poetry and some of them aren't. If I had to name one person who I read continually because it helps remind me of the lines between prose and poetry and how blurred they are sometimes and what all the possibilities are, it would be Gwendolyn Brooks, who's also Chicago homegirl, somebody I got to meet before she died. She was a presence in the city and kind of taught me everything a poet could be beside the person who's bent over the page sweating it out, that there were other things that you were responsible for doing besides writing the poems. And she was brilliant at that. Yes?
John Blake introduced me to some of the old articles you used to write for a paper.
Mm-hmm.
How often would you refer to those for inspiration?
I refer to the newspaper, like the skinhead poem that everybody... anyway, the skinhead poem was written because somebody painted a swastika on Plymouth Rock. And if you've been through New England, know anybody from New England, you just don't mess with the rock. And they couldn't find the person who did it, but they traced it to this group, and it was the White Youth League. It was like this white Aryan nation group, you know. And they found a representative who was willing to talk, and that's what I saw in the newspaper. And, you know, he was spewing all this hatred. I hate blacks, I hate Jews, I hate gays, blah, blah, blah. And it's funny, being a writer, you read those things all the time and you could just say, you could just dismiss him, or you could agree with him, and your life goes on. But if you're a writer, it's like, wait a minute, we both started here. And for some reason, he went that way, and I went this way. So let me see if I can write a poem that can kind of pull us back to center so we could go back to that place of possibility, you know. And so the newspaper... because it's the facts and only the facts, it's like you're lifting that story up and looking under it and saying, what else is there? You know, I saw a story about a man who doused his wife with gasoline and was chasing her around the house with a lighter. He wanted to throw the fire, set her aflame. And, you know, they came in, they saved her. The police had been out to the house several times for the same type of thing, and they asked her if she wanted to press charges. And she said, no, he was just a little upset because his dinner took too long. And you think, oh, no. You know, there are people like this for whatever reason. And being a writer, you're bombarded with those things all the time. What are you going to do about that? What are you going to do about that? What are you going to write about that? Who's that? Let's characterize that person. Let's delve into this. Let's go into there. You know, that's why writers are insane. We talk to ourselves. You know, we walk out into the open air, and we're just dodging ideas. And then we're scared because we think somebody else is going to do, you know, somebody else is going to do this. And then we think we've got it, and we go to the back of the paper, and you see a little article that says, man cooks lover in tomato sauce. So they hadn't seen him in a while. They break in the house. He's got her stewing on the stove. Not in water, in tomato sauce. Mexico City, article this big. You cut it out. You move it around on your desk. Until one day, you're trying to go to sleep, and that man says something to you. And you're like, I don't want to hear that, you know? And then he says something else, and you got to get up. You got to get up and write until he stops talking to you, you know? I didn't want to write about those drowned girls. I didn't want to do that. But I saw the article, and then not too long, I saw another article. And then it made me think, what's the dysfunction that causes a father to think his daughter is expendable because he's mad at the mother? And then I thought back to when I was growing up, and there weren't any fathers around. You were a freak if your father was in the house. I saw your daddy going into your house. What's he doing there? You know? And my father and my mother didn't get along, but my father came to the house and stayed there from the time I got from school till I went to bed. And that's crazy. But I had friends who would point their fathers out on the street corner. That's my daddy over there. That's my dad. Hey, Dad, you could go get some money from him. You know, haven't seen him in 2 or 3 weeks. There he is. And then I thought, okay, so the father can then get to a point where they have no real tangible relationship with the daughter. And that's a dysfunction that could lead to them thinking, I don't really know this child.
and it's the most important thing to the mother. So if I'm mad at the mother, so I had those two articles, and I did the same thing on my desk, moved them around, moving around, moving around. It's futile. It really is. You can move them around all you want, but if you cut them out, you will eventually write something. You have to. So the link in finding out all this chaos that we see, what's under it, it's like you're looking for the underbelly to things, or you're looking for an unexpected entry point to a story everybody thinks they know. So when you see something over and over, and I tell my students, who granted are not as smart as the students here, but I tell my students, make it personal. You know, don't write about the war. Write about a certain battle, a certain day, certain soldier, certain day in that soldier's life, certain hour in that day. Get it down to where we're looking somebody in their eye. The stories that we read, think, what am I not seeing? Who's on the outskirts of this story that's not in it? You know, something. And that's kind of what we do. That's why, you know, I was in Germany once, and they put all these poets on this train. And they go across the countryside, and it was stopping these little towns, and the square was decorated, and kids' faces were painted, and music was playing, and poets would get off the train. They would read. Everybody would feed them. They'd go back on the train and go to the next town. So I was in Berlin when the train came back for the last time. The train station was so packed with people waiting for the poets. They had placards with the poets' pictures. They were waving flags. They were in tears. They had to close the station down. And the doors would open, and it was so crowded, they had to pass the poets over their heads to get them off the train, because the poets are where the truth is found. And they revered their poets that much. We don't feel that way, as we know here, but it helps if, as a poet, you think that way. So when you're looking at a story, you're saying, what can I tell people that they're not hearing? So a lot of that comes from voracious newspaper, news magazines, all of them. Yeah. Yes.
As far as, like, the imagery goes, and, like, painting pictures slowly, is it just, like, purely imagination for you?
I think a lot of that comes from, and I have to say that I owe an incredible amount to the Poetry Slam. I don't think I would have followed the path that I did. But what you're doing when you get up and you've got 3 minutes, and you know that the people are not going to be able to go back over the poem when you're done, you have to pick them up and put them inside the poem. Okay, you've got one chance, you know. They can't backtrack. You have to do that. So you have to paint the picture for them the first time and as quickly as you can. So when I would be editing those things, it was like, okay, I would give it to people and say, can you see it? Tell me what you see. If they're not seeing what I'm trying to get them to see, then I know my work's not done, you know. So that's what makes people walk away with your poem as opposed to forgetting it when you finish the last line. They're able to see, and, you know, sometimes they can't shake it because you put them so firmly into the poem. So I think that's where the imagery, that's how it developed, that's how it started. The fact that I didn't have the time or the endless lines to get people to see what I was trying to do. Yes.
Back to, I guess, your journalism career.
Mm-hmm.
Transition from journalism to poet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in that because I'm a PR major. I take a lot of journalism classes, stuff like that. So I'm just generally interested in how you made that transition.
It's funny though, but see, I got, before I was writing poetry, I went with a bunch of people I was working with. We saw that there was a poetry festival in a blues club, 5 hours over the course of a winter afternoon, and this is in Chicago, so A, you could do anything to get out of the cold, and it's in a blues club, so we basically said, let's go get drunk and listen to the poets. Or laugh at the poets is what we said. Let's get drunk and go laugh at some poets. Because we had the old outmoded idea of poems. It's like, oh, there's going to be some poem about some flower growing through concrete. Or it's going to, you know. And one of the things I realized from going to that thing, which is coincidentally the first place I saw Gwendolyn Brooks, was that I kept visualizing a news story being one side of the coin and the poem being the other.
you know. So that practice of looking at a story and saying, where is the poetry in this? I mean, the Undertaker story came from seeing all those news stories about the kids who were being shot in the head and doing a straight interview with the Undertaker and then realizing that there were things that could not be put into the story, and that's what needed to be in the poem. So, you know, the same thing I said to the young lady back there is, if you ask yourself what you're not seeing, it doesn't have to be a transition. Like, I need to find step A, B, and C to move from this genre of work to this thing. I think it's an expansion of what you're already doing and not a totally different thing. I used to have parties at my house, and the journalists would be on one side and the poets would be on another. They'd all be glaring at each other like they didn't all use language, you know? the same thing with the supposed line between poetry and prose or playwriting or anything else. The most important thing is the story and not necessarily the mode that you use to tell it in, okay? So if a story is worthwhile being in a newspaper, it's worthwhile being a poem, you know? And if you start to approach the journalism like that, I mean, saying this is all that is allowed here for this reason, now let me go relish what wasn't allowed here. Let me, you know, we read stuff in the paper all the time that makes us angry and that saddens us or whatever. And so that calls for further exploration beside what you're seeing in front of you. So I think instead of a transition, it's like, how can I take this and move it like this? Okay? Thank you. Thank you. I'm finished now.